paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
State Player on 720 WGN. So from the minute it opened on Christmas Day in 1865, the Chicago Union Stockyard was Chicago's must-see tourist attraction, drawing more than 500,000 visitors each year. Families, visiting dignitaries, even school groups all made trips to the South Side to tour the Union Stockyard. Then they got a firsthand look at the city's industrial prowess as they witnessed cattle, hogs, and sheep disassembled with breathtaking efficiency. And at their height, the kill floors employed 50,000 workers and processed 600 animals per hour. Now, there's a new book out called Slaughterhouse, Chicago's Union Stockyards and the World It Made. It tells the story of the Union Stockyard, chronicling the rise and fall of an industrial district that, for better or worse, served the public face of Chicago for decades. And marking the 150th anniversary of the opening of the stockyard, Slaughterhouse is an engrossing story of one of the most important and deadliest square miles in American history. And joining us is the author of the brand new book, and that's Dominic Pasiga. Good morning to you, Dominic.
Good morning.
You know, before we dive into the very beginning, 150 years ago, you grew up in the shadow of the stockyards.
Yeah, I grew up in the back of the yards, and I worked for the stockyard company as a young man.
And your grandparents, they left Poland to arrive in the back of the yards just before World War One, and they worked in the meatpacking industry as well as some of their children.
Sure, yeah. My family had a long history in the stockyards, and but most of them had left after World War II. We stayed in the neighborhood, but we left the industry for the most part, except for an aunt or so. And when in 1969, I was walking through Packingtown and came upon the stockyard, applied for a job, and went to work.
And you did as well.
Yeah.
That was a generational thing, really, back then. I mean, you know, that was something that kind of passed down. Grandpa worked there, Dad worked there, I worked there. That just happened for a lot of families.
Sure.
Before construction of the stockyards, is it true that livestock owners would hang out in bars while tavern owners provided pastures and care for the cattle that were waiting to be sold? I mean, was that the way it was done before the stockyards?
Yeah, sure. There were various small stockyards in Chicago that were established after 1848. The first one was Bull's Head Stockyard at about Madison and Ashland, Ogden and Ashland. And basically it was a tavern. You brought your livestock in, they were sold, and took your money and went back home.
You bought a beer first.
Well, of course, you had to have one or two.
That's right.
So, yeah, and over time it became a much more complicated situation, commissionmen, et cetera. And then in 1865, the opening of the Union Stockyard, which combined all these little stockyards into one.
So that's how that really came together in 1865.
Right.
Now, we are living in a day and age of modern technology. You know, everything on an assembly line, everything is manufactured and produced. But back then, it was really a unique bonding of man and food.
Oh, yeah, very much so. You know, I mean, one of the things about the process at the stockyard was so shocking to people. I mean, most people knew how to slaughter a hog or had seen a hog being slaughtered.
When I saw the pictures in the book and the descriptions on how this happened and how tourists would see it, it is a little shocking. But,
sure.
I mean, that's just how it's done. That's how food gets on the table.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the turn of the century, it took a skilled butcher and his assistant about 8 to 10 hours to dress a steer. It took 35 minutes at Armour & Company. So this was really the shock of the modern.
Wow. How did the bidding process go when livestock was presented? How did that go?
Well, livestock, let's say steers or hogs, would be in a pen, and buyers would come by and bid on the animals, only one buyer at a time. So it wasn't in sort of an auction kind of thing.
Okay.
The commissionman could either accept the offer or turn it down. If he turned it down, the next buyer would come in. Now, at the end of the day, the first buyer might come back and make another offer. So it was sort of a bidding process.
But you drove them to Chicago. It was by train, by whatever.
By train, yeah. Eventually, at first they were driven on the hoof. So you could be living on Archer Avenue, open your door, and 200 hogs could be walking by.
Wow.
On their way to the cattle, on their way to the slaughterhouses.
Wow.
Eventually trains took over most of it. And then after World War II, really, the truck became the predominant mode of transportation.
Okay.
So when I was there, I'd say easily 90% of the livestock brought into the yards were brought in on livestock trucks.
Now, if purchased, the livestock went into the packing houses. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the process, because, again, this is something that tourists saw. This was reality on what happened when they were processing meat.
Okay. So, well, what would happen is, let's say you were a buyer from Armour & Company and you purchased the animals. The animals would then be driven to a scale. They'd be weighed, and a check would be made out to the farmer and to the commission man right away. Then they would be driven up a ramp to an overhead viaduct, which would go over the top of the stockyards so they could avoid all the pens and traffic, et cetera, to the packing houses. They'd be driven to the top floor, actually to the roof, where they would be yarded and calmed down for a while, and then they'd be brought into the process. So about 12 or 15 hogs at a time would be brought in, and the shackler would shackle his hind leg. The Hereford wheel would lift a hog up into the air, and then he would pass through an army of about 120, 150 people on his way to the cooler.
And that's, yeah, and that's, it was such a stringent process that lasted for decades.
Oh, yeah.
On how that was
yeah.
done. And they used everything. I mean, every part of this animal was used. The hair of the hog's ears were used for paintbrushes.
Right.
For example, I was reading, which was very interesting, but they used every single piece of this animal.
Sometimes blood was used to make buttons.
Buttons?
Yeah.
Wow. You talked about the wheel. What about cattle and sheep and the rest?
Cattle and sheep. The sheep were killed in pretty much the same way, except the wheel would lift up two sheep at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Cattle, on the other hand, were driven into narrow pens, and there was a platform above the pens where the stunner was standing with his hammer, and they were very narrow pens. They couldn't move, and the general attitude of the animal was to buck with his head. So you took the hammer and you rubbed his nose. And then he looked up, and then you came down with the hammer.
Wow.
And then this part of the wall slid up. He was shackled and picked up and on his way.
And, I mean, it just happened that quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I know there's been stories about, you know, back in the stockyards, there was a lot of waste. And a lot of that waste went into the Chicago River, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, into Bubbly Creek.
Bubbly Creek,
which
yeah.
still bubbles.
So. I know it does. Yeah. So many decades, 100 years later.
Yeah.
Which is surprising to me, but that's where the leftover whatever would go.
You know, there were reports that the river would turn red at certain times of the day when the slaughter was up high. You know, a lot of that was cut back over the years. The byproducts industry was very important. And actually, packers made their margin on the byproducts industry. So a lot of that was cut back. But the Army Corps of Engineers a few years ago did a study of the bottom of Bubbly Creek, and there's 6 to 8 inches of gelatinous material still on the bottom.
Really?
Yeah. So it's they thought that they should have perhaps cover it up, and then you could bring the creek back to life. You know, you would have to put some sort of a sealant over it.
Okay.
But I don't know if that'll ever happen.
Wow. Now, as the stockyards grew over time, so did the businesses surrounding it. I mean, that's really what kind of fed this business beyond the stockyards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, especially taverns. There were 40 taverns in a row on Ashland Avenue. It was called Whiskey Row. There's still one standing there, Stanley's Tavern on 43rd and Ashland.
Just one left.
Yeah, yeah. It was run by Wanda Couric. And the rest are all gone for the most part. There was 6 taverns on the intersection of what was then called Gross Avenue, is now called McDowell Avenue, and 46th Street, and that was called Whiskey Point. And then, of course, on Halsted Street, you had a row of taverns also.
But there was meat packing, there was storefront butchers, there was obviously other things that kind of existed as a result of that.
Sure, most of the packers had wholesale markets so that local butchers could come and buy, take them back to their storefronts, et cetera. I mean, it was very, you know, it was estimated in 1890, I believe, that 1 out of every 4 Chicagoans was somehow dependent on the meatpacking industry for their living.
That made sense.
Yeah.
That was
it.
That's what grew the city.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That's what grew the city. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nations, freight handler, stormy husky, brawling city of big shoulders. That was written by Carl Sandburg, which described Chicago in 1914. I mean, he knew this. We were the capital.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, shortly thereafter, the peak of the stockyards hit, with 18 million head of livestock twice in the 1920s. And then it began to decline. Between 1893 and 1933, there were never fewer than 13 million head of livestock a year at the stockyards. After that, the numbers went down. They peaked again a little bit during World War II, up to about 10 million. And then after World War II, there was a precipitous decline. But there were, in its 105-year history, about a billion head of livestock at coming into Chicago.
Wow. We're talking to author and historian Dominic Pasiga and his new book, Slaughterhouse. And there's more after the news next on 720 WGN. State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to author and historian Dominic Pasiga and his new book, Slaughterhouse, Chicago's Union Stockyards and the World It Made. Tell me about the people that worked there from the very beginning to modern times. It was obviously a lot of immigrants and you know, Irish and Italian. It was just a wonderful mix that built Chicago.
Sure. The first packing house workers were mostly Irish and German, then some skilled Bohemians. By the 1880s, 1890s, Poles began to come in, Lithuanians and other East Europeans. By 1915, 1920, you started to see large numbers of African Americans, and by 1920s, Mexicans. When the major packing houses closed in the late 1950s, about 80% of the packing house workforce was either black or Hispanic.
So it was again, an incredible mix of people. Now, the slaughterhouses and the packing rooms did create some major health issues for the workers. I mean, that's something you think about really turn of the century and beyond before you even thought about protecting your workers. I mean, you're exposed to a lot of
sure. Yeah, there were a lot of various kinds of skin diseases, lung diseases, especially in the fertilizer plants. It was not as dangerous a job, let's say, as the steel mills. The steel mills were known as a sort of killer of human beings,
mm-hmm.
But it was fairly dangerous in many ways. That you got sick, or people were going in the coolers, out of the coolers. They were getting pneumonia. The tuberculosis rate in the back of the yards was 67% higher than the rest of the
city.
Wow! Yeah.
Wow! Now, I just never would have guessed until I read the book that this was a tourist attraction. I mean, by the turn of the century, over 500,000 people toured there. And I apologize because I got a couple texts in that's like, I'm trying to sleep. This is too much to listen to. It's amazing to know that, I guess from a field trip perspective and so forth, but to walk through there, it was a modern marvel at the time.
Absolutely. People were confronting the modern. A friend of mine, Perry Dewis, another historian, talks about Chicago as a window to the future. And in many ways, the stockyards was the center of that window. People came in and just saw everything happening so quickly. And it was spectacle and innovation. And the stockyards always had this idea about spectacle and innovation. I mean, the Chicago Cubs, who were originally the Chicago White Stockings, mm-hmm. played their first game at the stockyards.
Oh, that's cool.
In Dexter Park.
That's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
At that time, the operation was so big, they had their own fire department
mm-hmm.
and 100-man police force.
Right, yeah. And even till the end, till the day they closed, they still had their own security guard system. And,
wow.
Yeah.
Union Stockyards had quite a bit of political and economic power as well, especially in the city's race and labor relations because it was so big.
Yeah, absolutely. And, they played ethnic groups off against each other, fragmentation in the union movement. So Poles would break a strike, then some other group would break the Polish strike, and then African Americans were brought in as strike breakers, and Hispanics were brought in as strike breakers. And there's this constantly churning over. They often tried to mix ethnic groups and departments so that the people couldn't speak to each other, and so they couldn't unionize.
Oh, interesting.
Or they would mix rival groups, people that didn't like each other back in Europe in the same department.
Wow.
Wow.
Just to cause a little uproar in there. In 1924, the Union Stockyards received the greatest number of livestock in its history. 18.6 million heads of livestock mm-hmm. unloaded at its docks. Was that the time of its heyday? Would you say it was the 20s or was it earlier?
That was certainly the peak.
Okay.
I think the heyday was probably a little bit earlier, but that was certainly the peak. And then it starts to decline very quickly because of direct buying and because of the increased use of the truck.
And where did where was everything sent to? I mean, it was all over the country, all over the world. Where was all this sent?
Well, especially after 1869, when Chicago basically connects the two coasts. Mm-hmm. Chicago is a huge hinterland from which it can attract livestock, but it has that vast transportation system which sends meat east. Swift, Armor, they opened their own wholesale houses in New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, put local butchers out of work because they can produce meat at a much lower cost. And they're willing to take a loss until they get control of the market. And eventually, Swift even is in control of the Western market in California. Swift basically becomes the meat producer for the San Francisco Bay Area and even for Manila. It's just this whole reaching all over the place.
How did, in the earlier days, how was the meat transported? I mean, I'm assuming there was freezer cars, refrigerated cars, trucks?
In 1868, in Hammond, which Hammond Packing, Hammond, Indiana, is named after him, did the first group of chilled beef to the east. It wasn't very good. It was Swift then that actually was able to develop a refrigerated car. And from that point on, the meat packers began to dominate the industry. The Chicago packers began to dominate the national industry. And, of course, you know, if you have a refrigerated car and it takes meat down to Florida, why not bring oranges and, you know, other things back? So they begin to get their hands into various other kinds of food products, even milk distribution.
Now, until 1939, perhaps 80% of the mostly white ethnic families were in the back of the yards, but that did start to change over time.
Yeah, especially after World War II. A lot of the guys coming back from the war didn't want to stick pigs anymore. They began to think about what they called cleaner jobs, mm-hmm. Western Electric and Cicero, places like that.
Now, processing modernization had been an issue for the stockyards all along, but it was really the 1950s that things began to significantly change, and the writing on the wall started to become apparent a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, partially, if you think about suburbanization, I like to think about the sort of ranch home. It's all on one level, and well, that's exactly what happened with factories. So you could bring livestock in at one end, and it would go out on the other end. Back in the stockyards, these were 8-9-story buildings. They took a lot of maintenance. They were old, wooden floors. The city was putting pressure on them about pollution and about...
Well, even the wooden floors isn't obviously very sanitary to business
Yeah. And so, you know, they could pull it down, but there wasn't enough space to put these 1-story buildings and have all the meatpackers in the same area. So there was a lot of pressure. And also the meatpackers wanted to get away from the central markets because they were now buying directly from farmers. So, you know, they could call you up and say, you know, how many steers do you have? We'll give you the same price you could get at Chicago. Well, you know, that lasted for a while.
Now, the Union Stockyard closed in 1971. There were several years leading up to it. They were going to close. They closed partial buildings and so forth. How did that whole closing down process start?
Well, it actually began once Armor closed. Armor was the president of the Armor Company was William Wood Prince, and he was also had been president of Union Stockyard Company. So there was a feeling that it would stay. It didn't. He began to decentralize. Once they closed and moved away, Swift had gone. Agar Packing left shortly thereafter. So the local packers began to leave. So the stockyards tried to modernize, tried to make it a little bit easier for livestock owners to come in and to ship their animals other places to off-market packers. So they closed everything north of Exchange Avenue, and they built a factory district up there for the Central Manufacturing District. It was obvious then that if there wasn't some sort of huge revival of the stockyards, that the rest of the land would go the same way.
And, you know, they knew it was going to develop into more industrial properties mm-hmm. and so forth over
sure.
time as well. But then, you know, again, it was, they're going to close. Well, they're just going to close these parts. Well, they're going to close mm-hmm. again. It did linger for a little bit.
It lingered for a little bit. And, you know, they always sort of kept the hope out that it would stay open or that a part of it would stay open, you know. And frankly, had it stayed open, it probably would still be there.
Yeah. There are still some slaughterhouses left in Chicago, aren't
mm-hmm.
there?
Yeah. There's Park Packing on 41st and Ashland. They harvest. That's the new term.
Okay.
They harvest animals.
Okay.
Hogs and occasionally goats. And Chepetti Packing on Halsted Street, which is run by a group called Barkat now for the slaughtering process. And they do sheep in Chicago. So those are the last two left.
Those are the last two. There are, I was at the Chicago History Museum over the summer. There are some pieces, including the original kind of the overhead fortress that sits in the Chicago History Museum. Mm-hmm. There's not much left, is there?
Well, the stone gate is still there. Yeah. There's some old packing houses that are still there. You can see, but most of it is gone. The Livestock National Bank building is there, and it's been boarded up for 40 years. There's all these occasional proposals. It looks like Independence Hall, and this was an advertising marketing ploy on the sides of stockyards. If you sent your livestock to Chicago, you kept your independence as a farmer. And so they had this bank building look like Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Yeah.
And there's a company called The Plant that's there right now. Yeah. I had John is his name,
John
right?
John Adel.
I had John on my show earlier this year. What an interesting way to reuse these buildings.
Oh, yeah. Pure Food Packing was the packing house that was there. And it's now The Plant, and it's a food incubator, doing all kinds of really interesting stuff, including farming, indoor farming, year-round. He has he raises tilapia. It's a wonderful place. Yeah,
great way to reuse
stockyards.
Absolutely. Yeah. Author Dominic Pasiga and his new book is Slaughterhouse, Chicago's Union Stockyards and the World It Made. Fascinating book. Just great content, great pictures. And it's available wherever books are sold, and visit your local booksellers to pick it up. Dominic, thanks so much for joining us in studio. I appreciate it.
Thank you.